Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Listen to KMOX anytime, anywhere. Download the radio.com app today.
Mr. Trump has magic about him.
This is the greatest country in the world, but we do have some really stupid people.
How can I describe our leaders better than the word stupid?
This guy has magic coming out his ears.
This is the most unethical sham.
So in the words of my late friend Aretha Franklin, show some R-E-S-P-I-C-T.
Now, Mark Reardon.
I've never known a guy more talented at untangling politics so that anyone can understand.
On St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to another hot and sticky day here in St. Louis on this Tuesday as we get started with a lot to get to, including the apparent firing of a Mizzou professor for making a bad dad joke. Dave Klein, you should be familiar with these. This is kind of like the jokes that you make at home with your boys.
Oh,
it's
now,
kind of a dad joke.
Now.
Well, I mean, it was kind of. All right. But, you know, I guess the point is it's sort of a harmless joke. We'll get into it here as we get started with the program. I got Dr. Garza coming up. I thought it was a good time to check in with him. We do that basically every 3 weeks from the St. Louis Regional Pandemic Task Force. I mean, some of the video that's coming out of Kenosha, and we knew it was going to happen, is just horrifying. Dan O'Donnell, who's my friend, he's at WISN Radio in Milwaukee, is going to join us a little later this afternoon. I saw, and we posted this video earlier on Twitter, of this shop owner who was just trying to keep his store from being burned down in Kenosha, and someone runs up, clocks him in the head, he falls down. To their credit, there were a couple, I don't know if they were protesters or just people that were on the scene that, you know, try to help this guy, but it's just horrifying. And it's not getting better. And CNN is treating it like it's, you know, just a walk down the street. They don't even cover this violence. So that's disturbing in and of itself. So Joe Poor is a professor at the University of Missouri, and he's a sociology professor. So, you know, I have some experience with how these Zoom calls are going. We had kindergarten Zoom call yesterday, another one today. And, you know, it is what it is, but it's awkward. And the kids are not comfortable with it. I don't think the teachers are comfortable with it. So Joel Poor is doing a Zoom class. He's doing a meet and greet with his students. He's got some international students. Now, I'm going to play you the full context of this. The part, Dave, we'll pause it when the part comes on that got him into trouble. You'll kind of be surprised here probably. Maybe some of you won't. I mean, it's cancel culture. You do anything wrong, you're out. You get canceled. So here's the conversation.
Anyone else from outside the United States? And where are you from?
China.
China? I've heard of China. Where are you from in China?
Actually, Wuhan.
Wuhan? Let me get my mask on. Okay, hold on. No.
All right, so that's the clip where he gets some attention on social media, where there are concerned citizens out there, woke citizens and woke people on Twitter that say, fire Professor Joel Poor for his racist and xenophobic comment. Now, that might not have been a good joke. I think it was more just an awkward response to hearing that your students are from Wuhan. I mean, how do you even respond to that? Obviously, you know the implication of that. You don't want to say something insensitive, but he sort of backs away from the camera on the Zoom call like he's going to put his mask on. And then the conversation goes on. By the way, there were some people who had tweeted about this saying the kid involved here, the student that answered Wuhan, he didn't care about this at all. It was everyone else that was too woke, and they thought this guy should be fired. So the rest of the conversation, I don't know if if Professor Poor is kind of feeling that the comment was awkward and he needs to make up for it, or something else happened, or if he's just basically trying to get through it. Here's what he said.
Now, well, welcome, and have you had any problems with the, you know, with everything in terms of traveling, or
I stayed here since last semester. So I stayed in the United States for the whole pandemic time.
In the summer, were you able to get back?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you need a place to stay, an extra bedroom and stuff, if things get tough, I don't know. I'm sure you're all taken care of, but it's been a real problem for a lot of Chinese residents and travelers into the United States and stuff. So I've only been to Shanghai and Chongqing in China, so I haven't had the pleasure of going to Wuhan.
All right, so basically, that's it. That's all he said. And Mizzou is now countering, saying he hasn't been fired, but he has been removed from his teaching privileges. They put him into administration. Now, there's some indication that maybe this guy's known for bad jokes. Bad jokes are different than offensive or misogynistic or bigoted jokes. Here's the secret. I don't mean to offend those of you in academia out there. There probably are some people listening. For the most part, this is a generalization that's pretty accurate. People in academia are weird. They're weird. They're awkward. And they're not normal. So he's a weird dude. We've all had weird professors. I guess not all of them are weird, but they're like politicians. And I say this with love. They're all weird, except for Eric Schmidt. He's like the only guy that's not weird. I don't know what it is, but college professors are bizarre. And they're usually big lefty, you know, anarchists to boot. I don't know anything about this guy outside of bad dad jokes, but they actually put him and took him out of the classroom for that. That's where we are right now in 2020 with the cancel culture. You can beat the snot out of a white business owner in Kenosha, Wisconsin with no repercussions whatsoever. It doesn't matter. You're basically going to get praised by Black Lives Matter. That's what they do. I'm talking about the organization. They love this stuff. They thrive on it. They want this. They encourage it. But if you're a professor, you got a kid from Wuhan, kind of weird just to hear that, and you awkwardly respond, you're done. Cancel your career down the toilet. It is quite stunning where we are.
You're listening to The Mark Reardon Show.
When you're out of my sight, you must constantly Twitter me exactly what you're up to.
Follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Reardon, KMOX.
And you can also check out The Mark Reardon Show Facebook page, and you can follow on Instagram for pictures of my dogs and my daughter at Mark Talk. By the way, I feel like I have to put a little caveat on my rant against those of you in academia. I'm not talking about like teachers. Like Dave Klein's wife is a teacher. Not high school teachers or junior high teachers or elementary. I'm talking about like college professors. You know you're weird if you're listening right now. You're weird. I say it with love. The only people who want to hang out with members of academia are other members of academia. That kind of speaks volumes right there. We are joined this afternoon by the head of the St. Louis Regional Pandemic Task Force, Dr. Alexander Garza. We ran down some numbers for you yesterday afternoon. He's back with us, and I put something up on Twitter a little earlier that we'll compare and contrast with. Dr. Garza, welcome back. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you, sir?
I'm doing a lot better than I was a week ago. I shared this story on the air yesterday. I was just knocked down, Dr. Garza, like you wouldn't believe, by a virus that included a fever for 6 days, fatigue, oh, wow. Muscle pain, but negative COVID test. My wife had the same thing, negative COVID test. So I guess I have to sit back and say this was another weird virus, right? But I mean, the fever kind of went away and then it would kind of hit me. There were a lot of similarities to COVID.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing with the viral syndrome. That's what we call it, is a viral syndrome. And it has all of those very common things that you would see with COVID, you know, fevers, headache, malaise, muscle aches, all of that stuff. And so that's what makes it a little bit challenging to distinguish, you know, one viral illness from the other. So that's why you need the testing.
Well, and you know what? That was my message yesterday that, the you know, I was lucky. My test came back in about 28, 29 hours. My wife's took a couple of days, but absolutely that impressed upon me, you know, how important testing was because, look, you got to put your life on hold. I mean, you got to be careful if you're sick anyway, but with the quarantining and just the way you have to adjust your schedule around everything else is and gets very complicated. So I'm glad that I'm feeling better. I did this compare and contrast. Let me just get your opinion on this. And we've talked about this occasionally. So April 28th, 678 hospitalizations, 159 ICU, 113 on ventilators. For today or yesterday's numbers, and I've included PUI here just for the comparison. We've talked about that. The earlier numbers included, you know, patients under investigation, 379 for hospitalizations, 89 ICU, 50 on ventilators. So once again, we're a lot better than the end of April, but these numbers are very similar to just 1 month ago. I looked at July 27th, and the numbers, while the hospitalization numbers might be down, I think, well, no, they're up. They're up as well. So we're not, are we not making progress here, or are we making progress? Because I do hear some positivity when you get the numbers as well.
Yeah. So we were talking about this yesterday, that the team was, you know, in looking at those numbers. So I was looking at those numbers yesterday as well, and I was looking at the admissions numbers more so than the hospitalization numbers. And it does seem that we've sort of hit this plateau here where we're not going up significantly, but we're not coming down significantly either. And so in trying to piece that apart, we discussed a number of scenarios. So one, which probably makes the most sense, is, you know, there's a significant amount of virus that's circulating out in the community right now. And then we have some mitigation measures that we've put in place. So whether that's, you know, restricting the number of people in restaurants and bars, or closing bars, and then our masking protocol. But certainly that doesn't remove all of the transmission that's going on. So there's still a certain amount of transmission that's occurring in the community, probably because there's so much virus that's already out there. And unless you have everybody being very diligent about, you know, hand washing and wearing a mask and social distancing, you know, it's hard to see where we're going to have a really big dent in getting some of these numbers down, especially, you know, with some of the uneven application across the metropolitan area and a highly transient population and things like that. So, but I think your analysis is correct. We're sort of hovering right now on a number that we can't seem to move up or down.
So where does that leave us from a variety of perspectives? Because even going back to what I and my wife experienced last week, and I've talked to a lot of people that have very similar situations where they had negative COVID tests, but very, very sick. I mean, it knocked me down for a week. And I bring that up again because we get into, look, October's right around the corner. Let's just be honest. October, November. Right. We're at the end of August. We get into cold and flu season. You have more of this going on. I think people want to know, you know, and you address this, where do we need to be to maybe get back to more normalization? But I guess my question would be, how do you just avoid a complete vicious cycle over and over again? What's the end game there?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and it's one that we've been mulling over, you know, in just looking at the data. And so, you know, of course, end game for the entire thing is an immune population. So whether that's through natural disease progression or through vaccine, you know, we know vaccine's probably not going to come till spring of next year once you get through all the testing, production, dissemination, actually putting shots in arms, things like that. And so then what's going to happen between now and then is really the question. And as I said, it feels like, or at least the data suggests, that we've sort of hit this plateau where we're not moving anywhere. And so my best guess, and it's just that as a guess, is we're probably going to see not a huge decrease in the number of cases or the number of hospitalizations. And it'll probably fluctuate up and down a little bit. We won't probably see those big swings that we saw like back in the spring where we saw that dramatic decrease. But there'll still be some fluctuation, you know, and I say that because, you know, schools are starting now. And so we know we're going to have cases coming out of schools. That's just really difficult to prevent. Colleges are starting back. You know, all of those different things are going to have impacts on transmission, on cases, and all of the numbers. And like I said, it takes really a significant, you know, effort from the community with masking and social distancing to really have a much larger impact, just because there's so much virus out there right now, to really get that down. So I think what we're people, probably just going to bounce up and down now.
So what I think people would say, though, is in response, no, that's okay. There's a, you know, when we do these too, because I'm doing it at home, there's a little bit of a delay. So sometimes that gets complicated. But I think what people then sit back and they say, look, we flattened the curve. We did what we were asked. What more do we need to do in order? And I'll just use schools as an example. Yes, school's back in session for a lot of kids, but not for a lot. And they're at home. So I tend to be, I've told you this before, I tend to be a bit of a fatalist. So when I think about what happened with my virus and where we are with COVID right now, heading into the fall and winter, man, I don't see a lot of optimism. I heard somebody last night on a baseball broadcast talk about fans and stuff being back next season. I can't see where there's a path for that even into next spring, considering where we are right now. And I'm also a little confused as why is, and this is because I guess the virus has run its course to a certain extent out east. Why, you know, those cases are kept in check in places like New York and not resurging just a little bit.
Yeah, that's tough to answer. You know, all of the areas are a little bit different. You know, it might be because of different policies that they have in place, whether it's with, man, I don't know what their masking policy is in New York, whether it's mandatory across, you know, all five boroughs or whatnot. And so, you know, all areas are going to be a little bit different in some of the mitigation strategies they put in place. You know, New York also was, as you know, was extremely hard hit. And so they have a little bit more of population immune than we do here. Because as you remember, although we had a significant rise, it wasn't huge. It wasn't as bad as many of the other places around the country. And the sort of trade-off with that then is, you know, you have sort of this slow burn of building immunity in the population. And that's pretty classic when you look at different pandemic curves. So I share some of your concerns with, you know, this is going to be, you know, I've said this before, this is going to be sort of a long war where there's going to be, you know, fits and starts and some outbreaks and some suppression, and that's going to go on, you know, until we get to that end state, which is immunity in the population. So it's not, you know, I don't want to give anybody any impressions that, look, if we can just make it through flu season, then we'll be fine, because we're still going to be battling this, you know, up until we get significant immunity in the population. That may take until, you know, late spring of 2021.
So what about the death numbers, right? And a lot of people, you know, still go back and they'll say, look, we have not really spiked considerably with the death numbers. You have a majority of these cases early on, we know, came from nursing homes. I have no doubt, because I did a lot of research last week wondering if I had COVID, hearing from other people who did, who had devastating experiences. Some of them didn't, but a lot of them did have really bad experiences with it.
Yeah. So when you think about, you know, the outcomes of COVID, it's really easy to sort of turn it into the sort of this binary, either alive or dead. But the true outcome is there's a whole sort of spectrum of things that can happen. And we're learning more as we go along, too, with some of the long-term issues with COVID that are occurring even in previously healthy people. And so when you think about the outcomes, it's much more than just life and death. So there is, you know, some long-term issues post-COVID. There's also the sort of economic and quality of life issues as well. And so people that are lost from work or lost from quarantine or not able to go to school, all of these things all have an impact on the community. And so it's, you know, we try and stay away from just thinking about this as a life or death issue when there's a whole suite of things that happen. And so you can kind of compare this to people like that have strokes or some other medical condition. It's not just all about dying from a stroke, but you could have some long-term issues from a stroke or need some special help after a stroke or things like that. So that's really the way to think about it, is all of the different outcomes that could occur because of COVID.
Dr. Garza, always great to have you on. I know how busy you are, and I appreciate it. We'll probably do it again here in a few weeks.
Sounds good. Always appreciate it. Thank you, Mark.
Dr. Alexander Garza, who heads the Pandemic Task Force. Look, I don't know where this is all heading, and I'd like to be more positive and ambitious about getting things back to normal, but I do think that we're in this weird holding zone right now with the numbers, and some people still believe this thing is less serious than the flu or a hoax. Then you got the people who aren't willing to even come out of their houses because they're so afraid. I think there's more people like that than we're aware. And then maybe the folks in the middle who understand the severity, who are trying to do the right things, who are trying to get their kids back in school, we're left out in the cold, and there's really no solutions. So, and on the topic of schools, I'm going to get into that a little bit later here this afternoon as well. Probably after Brad Young, he's going to join us in the next hour. You know, this is an interesting case, and you're going to see more like it. There's a kid from Lindenwood University who has filed a class action lawsuit to get some tuition reimbursement. So we'll talk about that coming up.
News Radio 1120 KMOX, the voice of the Cardinals.
Yeah, a little Rolling Stones bumping back. Thank you, Dave Klein. Appreciate that. 236, by the way, this is the anniversary of one of the most important records in my life, and that might be our audio cut of the day. That would be Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run 45 years ago today. Attorney and occasional KMOX host Brad Young is with me this afternoon to talk about some potential in a lawsuit where there's a student that's trying to get some tuition reimbursement from Lindenwood. But first, let me check in with him this afternoon. How are you, Brad?
I'm doing great, and of course, the more important news is I'm glad you're doing better.
Yes, and I appreciate that. And you know what's interesting is, despite what happened last week with kind of being down with the virus, it was a month ago that I called you, and it was right before the Cardinals, you know, had to go on sabbatical for COVID because I had this trip planned. And you might remember, I'm like, hey, if baseball gets canceled, can you do the roundtable on Friday? Because I still wanted to fly out that weekend. And lo and behold, Brad, a rare moment in my entire life and career where I had some foresight came through for me. So I appreciate you pinch hitting that day in particular.
Always glad to help.
Well, all right, so I think a lot of us have thought out loud about, especially a lot of us who are writing checks for colleges and universities, about the potential for lawsuits like this. So this is a Lindenwood University student, Eldon, Missouri. Dylan Martin is the person who's leading it, but it's a class action lawsuit asking the court to refund students' prorated tuition and fees for the spring semester, during which the school moved all classes online. And obviously some of this would continue maybe into what's happening right now. So is there merit to a case like this? From my perspective, not being a lawyer, I would think that there would be.
Well, there are literally hundreds and hundreds, and we were maybe approaching thousands, of these lawsuits that are being filed across the country. And every university, I think, will eventually be dealing with this kind of litigation. And to sum it up, they're essentially arguing breach of contract because universities are charging the same amount of money for online classes rather than for in-person classes, unjust enrichment and conversion, which is another way of alleging theft. And there are some very positive legal arguments here that these students are making. And I think in the long run, while I don't think it's going to be necessarily the next asbestos litigation in terms of length of time or the value of awards, there will be findings in favor of plaintiffs because they have a valid cause of action.
So if in a class action suit like this in particular, usually you have to let's say you were an Apple iPhone user and you bought the iPhone in one particular year and there's a settlement at, you know, with that, which I think there was recently, then you're notified and you have to basically, I don't know all the particulars, but you have to make sure that you're signed on in order to get whatever compensation might be there. With a class action lawsuit, if this is the route that they go with these lawsuits, maybe I'm asking Brad if you could break down the difference between whatever individual suit versus class action, because in this case, let's say that the kid wins and there's some money that's kicked back to students, it may be relatively insignificant overall. Isn't there the potential for that?
Well, that's why these are class action lawsuits, because each individual lawsuit isn't going to have a large value or a large amount of money. So attorneys are attempting to put these into class actions, so we're talking about larger amounts of money. But there's some real questions here, Mark, about whether people can be lumped together in a class, because in a class action, everyone has to be similarly situated. But that's not true in college. Some kids are on scholarships. Some kids are on partial scholarships. Some kids the parents are paying. Some kids that they're paying, like me, yep. I borrowed money to get through law school, okay? So all of those different classes means that you can't lump everyone into one group, and that's something that the courts are going to have to work out.
So if some of this starts to have success, where does that take us from this perspective? So my son's at the University of Missouri. He sees another case from WashU or Lindenwood or whatever else happens. Does there then have to be a new class action lawsuit targeted at that university?
Well, there would be people would be invited to join the class. Once a class action lawsuit is established, people would either join the class or they would be sent notifications by the court stating that a class action lawsuit has been formed and you have to either opt in or opt out. So everyone would receive notices about that. You know, we've gotten those. Think about it, Mark. You've gotten them for if you use Yahoo or if you are used a certain type of cell phone service in the last 5 years. You get those notices, and you would get those types of notices here. Now, what to me, though, is interesting is, and this is what will have to be litigated, is there's a contract law phrase called force majeure, which is a French term that just means act of God. And so universities are going to be arguing that they don't have to fulfill those contractual obligations because an act of God, meaning the pandemic, will prevent them from fulfilling those contractual obligations. We've not dealt with that before on a force majeure basis nationwide, and to me, that's the most interesting angle to see how the courts deal with these lawsuits.
Yeah, that's interesting. Force Majeure, by the way, a pretty good movie from Sweden that was remade with Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Will Ferrell earlier this year, and it was horrible. So just so you know that. You don't hear that term very often, so I had to toss that in. Well, so then what would your legal handicapping of the success of these types of lawsuits be?
Well, here's the reason why I think most of these are going to be to some degree successful, because there's essentially two arguments that the plaintiffs are making, that they've been deprived of benefits or services and that they've got a diminished value of their degrees. I don't think the diminished value of the degree is going to hold water legally. But as far as the deprivation of benefits and services, I mean, think about every brochure you received when your kid started going to Mizzou about how it's going to change your life, you're going to smell better, your acne's going to disappear, the sun's going to be shining more brightly if your kid goes to our university. So they make all these promises. But the bigger factor is this. You can take an online course at any university, and they cost less per hour than showing up at school. That is pretty much an admission that the value of an online degree is less than the value of in-class or on-campus education. So the universities themselves have already admitted that there's a less value for online teaching. So I think there will be either settlements or awards for that diminished value, which will prevent universities from charging the full boat rate if you're just showing up via Zoom.
Interesting. Brad Young, always great to have your insight here this afternoon, and I appreciate when you fill in for me. It's going to be I'll be very curious to see where these go, because I think that they, you know, they do have a point and there is a case to be made, but it's a mess out there, and then you have to consider the other lawsuits that will come from COVID probably as well. Brad Young, who is with us this afternoon, KMOX legal analyst, always great to have you, Brad. Thank you.
My pleasure.
2:43 at the Voice of St. Louis. I want to talk a little bit more about what happened in Kenosha last night. We're going to get into this with Dan O'Donnell at 3:20, but just some observations. There's a big protest going on right now, this hour, with hundreds of people, if not thousands, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, chanting, "Hands up, don't shoot." We know where that came from, even though it was inaccurate.
Listening to KMOX has never been easier.
Siri, play KMOX.
Mentioned that we're going to spend some time with Dan O'Donnell, who is my friend from Milwaukee WISN Radio. Dan and I used to work together. He'll have the latest on what's happened in Kenosha, where it is just devastating. Violent protests, and they're not described as such in most of the media. I don't know where this leaves us moving forward. The bottom line is, ever since Mike Brown, it's going to continue to happen again. I believe there's another shooting in Mississippi. There is no attempt to look at actually what happened with the situation and the facts. Now, whatever happened in Kenosha didn't look good. I'm going to admit that right now. That video doesn't look good. You can say, why did they have to cap him six times or seven times? I get all that. However, it's not like the movies where you shoot once and the person drops the gun or the knife or they fall down. That's not how it works. Now, there is some indication that maybe he was going for a knife. I don't know. I took a wait-and-see approach 6 years ago with Mike Brown, The facts came out, totally vindicated Darren Wilson, but to this date. In fact, Cheryl Atkinson is tweeting right now, and Laura Logan online, because Laura Logan, who used to be with CBS News, says, and she posted a video of people chanting in Kenosha, "Hands up, don't shoot." Hundreds of people. And she said, interesting how this phrase has survived from Ferguson when I have interviewed those behind creating it, and official reports on this are revealing. And Cheryl Atkinson, who's also been really good on reporting on a lot of this stuff, said, you know, you should read the Obama Justice Department report on this and how Mike Brown charged the officer. But people don't want to believe that. There are so many people, even in St. Louis, who are influencers or whatever you would call them, activists, who probably never read that report. They don't want to know the facts. So what happened right before the 20 seconds of video in Kenosha? I don't know. But is the answer to some of this, somebody raised this question earlier. This is what you have to ask yourself. Did he deserve to be killed for this? No. Okay, so we can accept that. But sometimes these things happen in what is described as awful but lawful. And how do you change use of force if you have a guy that is being told repeatedly, don't go for the knife, don't go for the knife, don't go for the knife, drop the gun? And there are consistencies to all of these shootings, aren't there? And that's that people aren't complying. Now, he's got kids in the car. How horrifying is it that he's got kids in the car? Well, they were called for a domestic dispute. So I guess what people are asking, the protesters, the people who don't want to look at the facts of this case or any others, and I don't know what all the facts are. I don't know at this point. Maybe we won't know all of it because these guys didn't have body cams. Police should, what, have let this guy who's a fugitive wanted for domestic violence and sexual assault get into a car with three children and drive away? That's the argument. That's actually the argument that people are making right now, which shouldn't surprise you when it comes to what BLM is really all about. Now, I know a lot of you want to say, well, wait a second here. When I say Black Lives Matters, that just means I'm talking about police brutality, right? That's all I'm talking about. Well, no, that's not what the organization is talking about. You have to think about these things. So there's this interview with, well, let me play this audio first. This is from the Democratic National Convention and the LGBTQ Caucus. This is a real person taking part in the Democratic National Convention. Oh, sure, we got lots of kooks on my side. I'm fully aware of that. We highlight those. But listen to this.
Why can't folks imagine a world without the cops? Why can't folks imagine a world without prisons? Why can't people expand their imaginations to include community care, to include an abolitionist future? And I'm talking about, like, for real abolition, not just watered down DNC version of abolition. We're talking about abolishing the police. We're talking about abolishing ICE. We're talking about abolishing prisons.
Yeah, that's real. They're talking about that. They don't think Joe Biden's good enough because he's not talking about that. Then you have this Chicago Lives, Black Lives Matter organizer, Ariel Atkins. This is from an interview that was done a few weeks ago. What is your take on the police shooting in Inglewood and the subsequent looting downtown? This is when Chicago kind of took off after the shooting of Latrell Allen in that neighborhood. She says, a lot of people are really attacking our pages. They're like, oh, you support the looters. And yeah, we do, 100%. That's reparations. And like however people choose to protest, especially if it was definitely in line with what was happening with the shooting, which would be powerful to see people reacting without organizers just being like, we're angry and this is what we're going to do. We're going to take the power back. I feel like these stories, these Macy's, these Gucci's, the PNC banks, they're not here for us. The city puts way more money and investment into spending time and protecting their spaces and making sure they exist. And yet our people are constantly being pushed out of the city. Unemployment is incredibly high, and we're in an incredible situation. The fact that nobody gives a blank about these businesses over what's happening in this city right now and the pain that people are in and the suffering that's taking place. I don't care. I will support the looters till the end of the day if that's what they need to do in order to eat. That's what you've got to do to eat. Well, you got to be kidding me. This is what those... I've watched a lot of looting video. I've watched a lot of looting video from Chicago, from St. Louis. I don't see them grabbing sandwiches. Says anyone, raise your hand if you've seen any sandwiches being taken. I don't think I've seen any. I've seen a lot of electronics. I've seen jewelry. I've seen other things. Haven't seen too many sandwiches or snacks being pulled away from the store. So I think people are eating okay. Let's not over-exaggerate that. What do you think of Mayor Lori Lightfoot's comments about the looting? Here's what this BLM leader says. This is one of the leaders in this organization, which is proudly worn on NBA jerseys and elsewhere. Her response is, this is the same woman who literally said, well, I haven't heard anyone in real life say defund the police. When you go to her block and there are people that literally have signs in their windows that say defund the police. When people are literally protesting outside of her house every day screaming defund the police. And then when they're protesting outside her office. So, you know, she can say anything she wants. The whole idea, this is my favorite here. This is just the creme de la creme of the quotes. And this is what people believe. This is what a lot of these, you know, guilty white kids that are protesting right now in Kenosha. And I'm fine with people protesting peacefully and taking a stand for racial injustice. But that's not what this has become. Can we at least admit that from the past few nights, from Portland, from Minneapolis, from Ferguson? It's not what it's about. The whole idea of criminality, she says, is based on racism anyway. Because criminality is punishing people for things that they have needed to do to survive, or just the way that society has affected them with white supremacist BS. So it's like her deciding what is criminal and what isn't. Well, we have a system of laws in this country, apparently, and she doesn't appreciate this. So this is, again, this is one of the leaders of that organization. This is an organization that stands for everything that I just told you. So when your neighbor, your friend, or your sister wants to talk about all this, can you ask them a few questions about what it really represents and what this is really all about? Second hour coming up.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.